Welcome to KBOO, Marie-Aline Claire. Good to have you with us today.
Hi, Jan. It's good to be here.
Well, you are a member of the Southeast Portland Renters in Action, and you've been working on housing and tenants' rights for decades now. You have a lot to say about the current crisis we're in that I'd like to have you speak to today on disparities in access to housing, among other engines of inequality in this country, have certainly intensified during the pandemic. An Oregonian article on May 17th describes encampments in downtown Portland with people leaving garbage everywhere and taking over the streets and businesses worried about the reopening. Yet people on the street struggle to survive as they no longer have access to many of the places they've relied on for their own vital services. And renters face a new wave of potential evictions around the country. So, Marie, could you lay out a landscape for us of the different levels of the housing crisis?
Yes, this is quite a phenomenon that we have going on here. And it came upon us under a structural system for housing that pushed homeless people out decades ago, and it's just been growing. And then the renter problem came along in 2015 where rent spiked, so that added more homeless people. And these were homeless people that were housed and people who had jobs but were now homeless. And then it's continued, the housing prices just kept going up and up, and then we have the 2008 crash. So a lot of people haven't even recovered from the 2008 crash, and now here we've got the pandemic, and we weren't really prepared for this. Once the city and the state shut down, businesses, they weren't making any money, and so a lot of the business people just said, well, we're not going to be able to pay the rent. You know, and they just set that right up front, we won't be paying it. Renters realized they couldn't pay the rent if they didn't earn a paycheck, and those that were at the very bottom of the income scale, like making very low wages, like people working in fast food or working at Walmart or someplace with no benefits and having to rely on food stamps to get by, once people start to lose their jobs or were mandated to stay home from work, well, now what are they going to do? Because a lot of them, Jan, were already paying more than 50% of their income and very low income for rent. And so they were already struggling. So now not only can they not go to work, they got to worry about their health and they got to worry about, am I going to have a job to go back to when we do open up? And that was 3 months ago and our state isn't fully open. And then we had the homeless people that the neighborhood folks, mostly homeowners, were already complaining about having to look out their window and see cars parked around the neighborhood, pets tied to the posts, people sleeping in their cars, or homeless camps along the freeways or on certain streets in our cities that were just lined up with homeless people. And what they were complaining about was the trash, the needles, the garbage. And, you know, I went to some of these camps and I asked folks, how many people here in your camp are drug addicts? And out of like 30 people, you would maybe get one or two. And the rest were seniors, young people, folks that had jobs or were working but just couldn't afford to live anyplace. So the whole landscape changed. And so now when we get to COVID, we're running the risk of people who were at the lower income, who were housed, their long-term renters, now they risk ending up joining the homeless because they have no way to pay for rent. The rent bill is piling up even under the moratorium, which I'm really grateful that Oregon granted one.
And that includes a restriction on evictions, correct?
Yeah, so that they wouldn't automatically be evicted, but and it kind of put a backstop on landlords where it went down and filed for evictions for folks prior to the moratorium. And then I think later on, about 3 weeks to a month into it, the legal department went and refiled and said you couldn't push your claim through even though you filed it before the moratorium. So they put a stop on all of it. And they also added where landlords couldn't force renters into a payment plan. So they took that off the books, because landlords were sending out letters to renters that said, either sign this payment plan, you know, if you can't pay, or we're going to, you know, give you a 72-hour notice. So that got delayed. But the problem is the bill is still adding up, and renters don't know if they're going to have a job to go back to. And
so you're
and,
saying deferring or delaying payments not really address the crisis. It kind of gives people a little breathing room, but if you can't come up for air financially, that breathing room doesn't give you much.
Because the rule is they'll get 6 months to pay back the back rent, right? But the problem is you'd have to have a way to do that, like a job. And what's happening, because the businesses are being impacted by this shutdown, people are afraid to go out to the business. Because, like, for example, restaurants, you got to move them 6 feet apart. And now I understand some jurisdictions are asking that you put some partition between people. So people are very nervous and concerned about their health. I mean, we've had thousands and thousands of people lose their lives. And so you've got the health risk, you've got the job situation, and that's really shaky. And you've got businesses that are going out of business, because they were small businesses and they couldn't get a business loan even under the Federal CARES Act, where you could apply for the banks to get forbearance and then get a loan, but you had to meet a certain requirement. And actually the banks, after they got those billions of dollars, they tightened up the credit qualifications. You know, you had to have even a higher credit rating than before.
This is Jan Hawken talking this morning with Marie-Aline Claire with Southeast Portland's Renters in Action. Marie, I wanted to also have you talk some about how renters and activists in the housing community are addressing this pandemic, and particularly this issue you raise of the paranoia that people inevitably feel toward one another, having to keep distant and for medically necessary reasons. How does a pandemic affect organizing and some of the mutual aid work that has been very impressive during this pandemic among many community groups?
We're having to talk to each other and organize on Zoom. Zoom's making a lot of money from this, but it's a lot harder. It's actually health risk. Spending hours and hours getting radiation from our screens, and that's impacted me. It's impacted my eyes. My vision is getting worse and worse. But it takes a lot of resources. Like, you have to have technology. You've got to have computers. You have to be able to pay for Internet service, right? And a lot of people who are, for example, applying for jobs or trying to get services in the city, and you have to know how to use technology. Not only do you need to have the resources, and this is really impacting people like seniors and maybe families that their computer, their old one blew up and they couldn't replace it. And so under COVID, sitting there with no job and the rent payment piling up and having very little money for food, that money is going to go to just try to cover food and maybe a little health care, and if they can afford to keep paying for their health care.
Libraries and community centers have been places where people have been able to access computers, charge their phones, and you're saying that digital divide has widened in the course of this pandemic.
Exactly. And especially homeless people, they don't have anywhere they can plug in. In fact, the Poor People's Campaign representative here, they're having to take water over to the camp because the city didn't really provide the water. I understand there's a bucket and a spigot, but we have to get volunteers to go over and fill up the buckets with water. I think they're 5-gallon buckets. And they don't have anywhere really to wash up, clean up, go to the bathroom, didn't put a lot of porta potties out. It's very insufficient what the city has provided. it's shameful.
And the Poor People's Campaign, the Portland Metro Poor People's Campaign, is part of a national organization that is addressing this and so many other issues related to the spectacle of poverty that people might want to turn away from, but is the kind of the ugly face of this kind of capitalism we live under.
Exactly. Yeah, and they're looking at it from a moral standpoint, that culturally where we put profits over the lives of people. In fact, we're risking people's lives just pushing to open up the country. And as we're finding in certain areas of the country, like the South, there's repercussions from opening up too soon. The numbers of affected people are growing rapidly every day. So this is one thing I'm very happy about Oregon, about being very, very cautious and being very, very methodical about both the closing and the systematically opening up different areas. And I understand Multnomah County is going to be the last one to open. I think we have to weigh, is our life more important or is our economy more important? In the era where the feds are just printing up more money, our federal officials could just sit down, let's do a reset on everybody. But to, I think, make poor people suffer, the homeless people out there by themselves, basically, you know, sleeping in the street. So what if they're blocking the sidewalk, right? This is a shame that we allowed this to go on like this in the first place. Other people, you know, are sleeping in their homes. Right? They've got a bed to sleep in. They're undercover. Well, what about our brothers and sisters that are sleeping outdoors? Those were our children, our parents, our grandparents, our sisters and brothers, our personal sisters and brothers sleeping out there. Would we be calling the police and saying, well, we don't want to look at the garbage. We don't want to look at the horror that our society has produced. Would we then rather be saying, how can we help? What can we do? I think that's what we need to be clamoring around.
And before we close, Marie, I know you've also been involved in the Portland Metro Poor People's Campaign. Actually, that's where I met you on a Zoom session recently and was so impressed with the work you and others are doing, and both as activists and in organizing and encouraging mutual aid and providing for people at different levels of vulnerability, which is kind of obscured in this idea of opening up of the city. Well, the city is already open and people are living. And so what kind of next phase of opening are we talking about is always the question. How can listeners support tenants organizing or get involved with the Portland Metro Poor People's Campaign? And in closing, could you let listeners know where they can find out more about your work?
Okay. Well, they can contact the Poor People's Campaign online, poorpeoplescampaign.org. You can contact Southeast Portland Renters in Action by calling me at 503-995-0250. You can also contact the Community Alliance of Tenants. They're running a statewide tenant-led coalition. They can go to the Community Alliance of Tenants website and contact them. They can also contact me about it. We just finished up the advocacy team, which I led that team in putting together our plan of action. And there's many, many ways they can get involved. And I really encourage people to do so, to be part of the solution. And we need everybody's hand and help, no matter how small or if you have, we're home now, so a lot of people are complaining that they need something to do. So I would say now
there's plenty to
do. Yes, yes.
We're open for activism.
Yes, very, very much so. Very much so.
Okay, well, thank you so much, Marie-Aline Claire, for being with us this morning and for your inspiring work over such a long period of time and your wisdom in these troubled period of the pandemic that most certainly will continue beyond the pandemic itself. So it's so critical how we respond.
Okay, thanks, Jan.
Yeah, take care and keep up the good work.
coming to the end of a long, long walk when a man crawled out of a cardboard box under the E Street Bridge, followed me onto it. I went out halfway across with that homeless shadow tagging along, so I dug for some change. Wouldn't need it anyway. He took it looking just a bit ashamed. He said, you know I haven't always been this way. I've had my moments, days in the sun moments. I was second to none moments when I knew I did what I thought I couldn't do. Like that plane ride coming home from the war that summer. My son was born, memories like a coat so warm the cold wind can get through. Looking at me now, you might not know. I've had my moments. Well, I stood there trying to find my nerve, wondered if a single soul on earth would care at all, would miss me when I'm gone. That old man just kept hanging around, looking at me, looking down. I think he recognized that look in my eyes. I've had my moments, days in the sun moments. I was second to none moments when I knew I did what I thought I couldn't do. Like that cool night on the East Street Bridge when a young man almost ended it. I was right there, wasn't scared of being my hell to pull in through. Looking at me now, my moment.